You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM. This is Melting Pot, and it's my distinct pleasure to welcome into our studios Myron and E. How are you two guys doing?
Good. Fantastic.
Good.
Fantastic. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. It's been a long time coming. Been a fan of y'all's work for quite some time, and as we were talking before we actually started to do the interview. You know, it seems like this record has been coming out and coming out and coming out for a while. Now it's finally about to come out.
So it's
nice. It's nice to have all the music, and it's especially nice to have you here. And also, you know, after we do this interview, a guest DJ set, which is going to be especially nice for listeners out there. First off, just wanted to kind of start with the kind of two separate origin questions. You know, one that's connected to the two of you, and then also to this group that backs you up on the record, the Soul Investigators. But I wanted to start off with just if you could tell us a little bit about how the two of you got together and how you found your way to each other.
Myron and I met through the group Blackalicious. Myron was a background singer, and I was the tour DJ for the group. And I think when we started working with Blackalicious, it was pretty much right at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I went from just being a club DJ around the Bay Area to all of a sudden going out on these huge tours around the country, around the world, and pretty much just forced to hang out with one another a lot, because when you're on tour, there's nowhere to go but to the next place.
Yeah, I didn't like him at first because he tried to take my wallet out of my pocket. Get your hand in my pocket. No, I'm just kidding. We joke around like that all the time. So,
how did you because especially when you're on tour with a different group that's not necessarily kind of your group, it doesn't necessarily lead to creating music together. Like hanging out and kind of, you know, bonding over being on the same tour is one thing, but how did the kind of, like, you know, the start for making music together, how did that happen?
Well, I've always been I'm a DJ as well as a music producer, and I would always kick Myron beats back in the day and be like, hey, man, sing something on this track for me. Or, you know, so I knew his vocal ability and just music making ability was always, you know, spot on. And the whole thing with the Soul Investigators, that it was just a fluke, really. I mean, it was just something that happened to happen. I had no intentions of ever, you know, stepping to the mic myself to be a recording artist as far as vocally. So that's how we originally started doing music together. And Myron, you know, when we first started out on the road, there was several background singers that were out on the road, and everybody had a demo. You know, everybody in the band had a demo.
And here we go.
I remember, like, people giving me CDs, or different people that would come in and out of the organization that would give me CDs and be like, yeah, I'm working on my own thing. And then Myron gave me his CD, and it took a while before he gave me a CD, because he kept saying, like, yeah, I got something.
Myron Glasper Classics.
He was like, I got something, man. I'll give it to you later. And it must have took about 6 or 8 months, because we was always out. But, you know, it was a lot of females that were background singing with the group, too, and they would always give me CDs, and I'd be like, yeah, this is cool. Like, this is cool. This is cool. And then finally Myron gave me a CD, and I was like, dude, who did this?
He was like,
I did it. I was like, who did the beat? He was like, me. I was like, who mixed it? He was like, me. I was like, dang, and you sang on it, too?
Yeah,
this is pretty tough, man. Like, you need to do something with this.
And that was more of an R&B neo-soul-ish sound at that time. Continue.
And I mean, it was even one time we were in Australia, and I remember Myron was out on the floor dancing, and I was like, yo, I'm gonna play your song. He thought I was talking about I was gonna play something that he liked.
Yeah,
I literally played one of his songs, and the crowd was going off, and he was like,
oh, this is crazy. Sugarfoot. I remember that.
So, yeah. But, man. I mean, we've always clicked musically on the road. I remember, and one time specifically where I was looking through Myron's computer, and he had this cut on there by Layla Hathaway called Heaven. And I was like, man, what you know about this? You don't know nothing about this. And then
I popped in a CD.
Yeah, he had like the whole CD. We'd just be in here geeking out on like all kinds of old school R&B. I mean, just musically, music, you know. Yeah. Yeah, we've always had like a good camaraderie with music. So, yeah.
And I had actually had intentions on doing and actually signing to Quantum, which is the label that Blackalicious is on, and doing some stuff with Chief XL. But
okay.
I ended up over here on Stone's Throw. By way of Eater Boss, Soul Investigators, Helsinki Family. I mean, it's a nice place to be, though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At what point did you guys realize that that what you were creating was something that, more than just kind of like a friendship, was really something that was going to be a musical partnership, was something you're going to put work into and actually start recording and releasing music?
It happened quickly, though. The first two singles, we just went in, pen and pad, finished it, you know, sent it over there. They released it, and they released, what, two or three more?
Yeah.
And it still wasn't setting in, even though we had gone over there and spent some time. First time, maybe like 2 weeks. The second time, 5 weeks. But it still never really set in until after the Stone Machine got behind it. And it's still kind of getting its wheels going. It's starting to set in just now, really, for me, you know, because I'm not a skeptic, but I'm a realist.
Okay.
And, you know, dealing with the music business, you have a lot of talkers and, you know, not very many walkers. And I'm not saying that about anyone in particular or Stone, so it's just like, yeah, okay. Like the guys are like, we want to fly you guys over here to record an album. I was like, all right, I'll believe it when the plane is taken off. Not when you're at the gate, because something can still happen. But when the plane is in the air, it's like, I can sleep now. So it's starting to happen. Or it's happening, I should say.
Yeah. I would hope so.
Yeah.
With this record coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're getting a lot of good responses, and everybody's enthusiastic about it over at the label, and I'm happy. I mean, I look happy or excited, but I'm juiced, man. I'm so juiced. I'm telling you.
One of the hallmarks of your sound is the way that you guys harmonize, and the thing that's striking to me is that there's kind of like a number of different ways that you go about doing it, you know, kind of the standard ways for people to have their voices kind of blend so that almost it seems like a single voice. And there are times where you do that, but also where the distinction between your voices is very clear because Myron seems to be up high and Eric, he's all way down low. And then it also seems on quite a few of the records that it's almost like the two of you are singing with another two of you, or maybe even three or four. Like there's kind of overlaying of multiple vocals connected to that. And one of the things I always just I'm really fascinated by is just kind of like how people actually kind of find their voice and find their way into a sound. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that first, and then I'll re-ask you kind of a question about kind of the production style for Myron and E. So just how you kind of blended the different styles and different sounds the two of you had into this single kind of sound.
Well, as E mentioned before, he never really had any intentions on excuse me, stepping to the mic. But I've been writing for a long time, and I've been listening to a lot of different styles of music. But at the same time, he's been listening and DJing for a very long time. So it gets in there and it stays, you know, whether you're conscious of it or not. I've always been into harmonies. I've always been into different voices. And so in the beginning, I didn't really pay much attention to it. It just naturally came out. But then I'm listening around and looking around like, oh, no one else here today, you know, currently has the baritone or the bass. So I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. So now you can start doing bo-ba-dee-da-doo. You know, the Temptations had it. And it gives us a unique sound, but it also opens up more writing opportunities creatively. And like I said, I've always been into harmonies and whatnot. And then being on the road with Blackalicious, it was always an octave, you know, with the female singer and the male singer. But he's sitting there still listening to it. So he just kind of, you know, eased on in there. You know, he He's like, okay, let me see what MG's over there doing. Okay, right here. Okay, and he just fell right into it, and then the melodies just started coming. So, just naturally being into harmonies, and then having this added element of the baritone bass, made it even sweeter.
Could you talk a little bit about that E as well, especially since
sure.
There it is. If you could talk a little bit about that, especially because you didn't necessarily have that background in singing, it seemed like, at least.
No, I didn't. You know, it's funny, my a lot of my family members would always try to encourage me to sing. And there's been times in the past where I've sang around people and they would go, wow, man, you have a great voice. You should sing. And I'd just be like, whatever. But when this opportunity came up to make the record, it's funny, even when the opportunity came up to make the record, I didn't necessarily see myself as being, you know, too out front. I thought I was going to be like a bit more in the back. But even at that, when we first started recording, Myron was like, man, you can sing. So, you know, it just kind of worked out, man. And as of late, definitely as of late, the newer songs that we wrote for the album, you can definitely hear how we do the push and pull with the voices a lot more. You can hear it a lot more. It's 'cause we've kind of fallen into the pattern of knowing how to work it better, you know, as opposed to in the beginning where we were just like, oh, okay, let's try this, let's try that. But now it's, you know, we got a good, really good rhythm going with it. So
how much of the creative process has been something that you've been able to share with the Soul Investigators? Because both of you are based out of the Bay Area there in Finland. And so was it a situation where you were able to go over there to record, or did they send you music and then you wrote lyrics and just kind of mashed it together? Or like how did the actual recording of these songs happen?
Initially, the first two songs we did, which was Cold Game and I Can't Let You Get Away, they were all done with us singing and here in the States and sending the vocals back to them. And then after that record came out and, you know, there was some success behind it, they flew us over to Helsinki and we were there for 2 weeks. And we wrote and recorded pretty much for the 2 weeks straight. I mean, morning, noon, and night, we were just there working.
The bulk of the album.
Yeah. Then that was when the bulk of the album was recorded. And then we came back here to the States, and we had the demos. You know, we pretty much had all of the demos there. But then in the following year, we went back to Helsinki. And we did a lot of cleanup work on the record, you know, and at that point we had time to listen to it and figure out, you know, just things that we could do, add to make it better. So, yeah, the bulk of it was recorded in Helsinki. But then there were some more tracks that came along towards the end of the album, because when we signed with Stone's Throw, we needed to add some more, you know, they wanted us to do some more material. So there was even more recording done where we recorded here in the States, sent it back to them. They mixed everything over there and then sent it, you know, had the final product sent back.
Some of that process, it seems to me, is kind of the way, you know, for the most part, people kind of make music and have for long periods of time. Some of it also seems to be very, very much like made easier by newer technology, and it's more kind of like a, you know, late 21st century kind of thing.
Right.
And listening to this, even though this is soul music, most people don't think of it as hip hop. One of the things that I also wanted to ask you, and kind of thinking about how this sound comes together, was just kind of the influence of growing up around hip hop and performing, especially, you know, the two of you met while touring with Blackalicious, working as a DJ, working and producing your own music and doing it in that particular, just kind of the influence of hip hop on the kind of soul music that the two of you make.
Well, let me say something really quickly. This album wouldn't exist if it weren't for the internet. And I've always had this love, hate, yes, maybe relationship with computers. And I sat and thought, like, wow, this thing wouldn't even be in place, because we had to, you know, email the songs back over to them. And then that's when they flew us over to make it official. But the whole hip-hop element, you want to...
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, it's I'm not sure of how a lot of other people, especially in the quote unquote newer, you know, the newer old soul groups, how they do if they go into the studio and work with the band to create the tracks from scratch. But I mean, to me, that's one of the really unique things about this record is that it was written primarily like a hip-hop record. Mm-hmm. You know, we got beats, we wrote to them, yeah. We kicked it back to them, and then from there, you know, they would add strings and horns and all of the other kind of stuff to embellish on it. But yeah, this record was written pretty much like a hip-hop record.
And then the sonically, of course, you know, from being on tour with Black Alicious and other hip-hop acts over the years, it just naturally rubs off and becomes a part of it. So, and I think that gives us a little edge of uniqueness as well. Because people have actually said, like, it sounds old, there's integrity, but it still sounds fresh and new.
Yeah.
But it still fits into that category of old soul.
Yeah.
You know, seamlessly.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's one of the things just, I think when you grow up, yeah, if you work as a DJ, you work as an MC, like if you work in kind of hip hop in some way, or your ears are kind of attuned to kind of hip hop production, not just as a listener, but like if you know a little bit of like how things work behind the curtain, you know, then like you pick those things up, as opposed to people who are just trying to, in a very purist kind of way, just to kind of try and recreate 60s soul.
Right.
That's one of the things that I think really jumped out for the sound of the group, that that was in some ways kind of hard for me to explain early on, until I kind of learned more about you and like where you guys came from before coming together. It is one of those things, and this year especially, 2013 has been like this crazy great year for kind of music along these lines. We're not even halfway done with the year, but I mean, there've been like a lot of really good records around this kind of style and sound. One thing kind of connected to that, though, I wonder if, do you, in thinking about kind of labels and how people talk about the music, do you prefer for people to think of it as like a retro soul kind of sound, like Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings? Like those dudes are like pretty purist in terms of how they create their music.
Right.
You know, and there's some other kind of groups that are also kind of very similarly aligned. But I always wonder whether or not people actually like kind of being put into that category of retro soul. And what do you think of that label?
I think they intentionally recreate the whole retro soul sound so that it could be just that.
Mm-hmm.
But with me, as long as it's good and the people are enjoying it for ourselves, I'm down with it. There's still a lot of integrity attached to it. And I always mention Amy Winehouse, how her approach enabled her to, you know, tackle 6 Grammys,
mm-hmm.
because it gave it more universal appeal. But it was still good stuff.
Yeah.
You know, people can't say, oh, it's not this, it's not that, or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, we have like a group of people. What's the term? Firma Rola?
Oh,
Firma Rola.
Yeah.
They making those Firma Rolas. and that's the stamp right there.
Uh-huh.
With the lowrider Chicano community. That's the stamp.
Yeah, that was something I was going to ask you a little bit here after we talk a little bit about the record. So this record's getting ready to come out finally, full length record. It's called Broadway. And that was one of the songs, kind of one of the early singles on Broadway. And one of the things in hearing that, and this was just kind of like a quick thing, and it's almost in some ways kind of like a question that comes from my wife, just because she loves that song. She's like, oh my God, it's such a pretty, sweet song.
Nice.
Like, is that based off of a true story where you guys, or one of you, or somebody, fell in love at the Broadway BART station?
Well, do you even want to divulge? I think we both have separate stories, and we'll share. And I'll be totally... You know, up front, man, this is what it's all about.
All right.
You know, so you go ahead.
No, sorry to hurt your wife's feelings, but I did not fall in love with a woman at the Broadway BART station. It's a bit of it for me. A bit of it is true. I mean, you know, you just take personal experiences, but then you try to fit them into this thing that's going to work in 3 minutes. Yeah. So, yeah, it's just, it just all draws from life experience, you know, but it's, it, no, sorry, it's not, not Broadway Bart.
So why don't we take a listen to this song? This was an earlier single, but it's essentially the title track for the new record from Myron and E, coming out very soon on Stone's Throw Records. The name of the album is Broadway. The song is On Broadway. You're hearing it now on KPFK and Melting Pot.
Feel the same way,
and that's why I sing
my life.
Music from Myron and E right here at KPFK 90.7 FM and Melting Pot. The name of the song is On Broadway, originally released on a 45 on the Timian record label, but also it's going to be released on their upcoming full-length debut, which is called Broadway, coming out soon from Stone's Throw Records. Myron, you were I think you were going to say something about your writing process and also about On Broadway in particular.
When I write, I'll take from several different experiences, not necessarily just mine, to embellish or to finish the song.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't take away from the personal connection or the actual facts of the story. Now, sometimes I write about something that happened years ago to someone else that they talked to me about. And other times it's right on the spot. And I did meet some friendly people in Finland. I met, you know, a friendly young lady in Finland, and we hung out. And so when I would leave after we were finished, or if we had a break, I'd jump on like an old school bicycle from the war, and I'd ride over to one of the stations, literally, to meet up with her.
Okay.
Was it love at first sight? No, but then there are stories in my life that do connect to the love at first sight. Because if I were to just write about one thing, it may be a bit trite and boring.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people want to hear good stories.
Yeah. No, and there are great stories on the record. It's interesting, I think, you know, a fair amount of them connect to issues of love, you know, and that's the thing. A lot of times you're never sure like how autobiographical artists are when they write songs. Some people write songs that are just about their life. It's a direct lived experience.
Right. For sure.
Sometimes it's things kind of the way that you talked about it, where you're kind of drawing on life and using it as inspiration to go in a variety of different ways. I'm actually, in a way, as sweet as a song and as, you know, and beautiful and romantic, it is. I'm actually kind of glad that it wasn't a true thing, just because there's so the songs on the record kind of go from that kind of love to like a very kind of cautious or even kind of skeptical kind of love, especially when it goes from On Broadway to If I Gave You My Love, like back to back. It's like, well, hold on. They just got married. And now all this is going, like, what happened in the relationship? Like, you know, like you're concerned.
But that's true to life.
Very true.
And I'll be totally honest, man. Like some of these concepts and stories, not just with this music, are stories of my life. Like, can't let you get away. Like trying to work on it. Let's make this thing work. Blah, 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 blah. But you have to be in a certain mindset, too, to write. You can't be, like, in that particular moment. And I do have songs where, in its entirety, it's, like, every single word is true to the fact. But, like, the conditions that we were under in Finland, we had to get it done.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, we literally showed up. And from, I mean, we went directly from the airport to the studio.
Mm.
Well, we had a moment to go eat.
Right.
And that's when Get Me On Broadway showed up.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The funny part about Broadway was we had both of the verses written, and we were still struggling to record like the pre-chorus. And I don't know, it seemed like it took forever to do it, but we were just in the studio so much, and there was this huge graveyard up the street. And I just kept saying, I got to get out of here. I got to clear my mind. But I had a little portable voice recorder, and I went up and just walked through the graveyard and came up with the other part of it, walking through the graveyard.
Wow. And also, some of mine is wishful thinking. Mm. It's still a part of who I am and what I'm all about. But it's, you know, some of the situations I would like for them to be a certain way. And I can't remember everything in particular, but it's coming from inside, man.
Yeah.
You know, definitely. So
one of the things that's also nice about this record that is nice to see people do more of right now is there are several songs. The record in some ways is kind of bookended with songs that are really focused on a more kind of socially conscious kind of aspect of soul music, would turn back at the beginning and then Going in Circles and They Don't Know, The really, really strongly socially conscious kind of lyrics. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why you felt it was important to record those songs and put them on this record as well.
I think from the beginning, when we first, after we made Cold Game and I Can't Let You Get Away, the Soul Investigators, you know, as great as they are with making music, they really study this old music. I think a lot of what they wanted was for us to continue to recreate these achy breaky heart songs, and we were very anti that. You know, we were like, it's got to speak to more than just that. Like, we can't just keep having make up breakup songs. Mm-hmm. You know, fell in love, fell out of love jam. So, yeah, I think that's, you know, both of us continuously pushing that on them, saying like, hey, it's got to be a little more rounded. That's how that whole element of the album came to be.
And also with me, like, if my favorite rapper is KRS-One.
Okay.
And so I've always kind of had a conscious ear to the streets. You know, I met a holistic doctor out of Compton, California, and he used to have these meetings. And I was like, it was strange to me because I had never heard of it, totally, you know, oblivious to it. And I'm like, oh, okay, there's some other things going on in the world. But you don't want to be like, you know, conspiracy theorist, fear mongering. You just want to kind of like Mercy, Mercy Me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was it was a beautiful song, but it wasn't like I'm gonna scare you into, you know, being a prepper or whatever people do. And I'm not saying that these things don't exist, but it has to be more than just party, the love, and let's get together and make a family, because there's other things going on out there in the world that need to be, you know, at least brought to the forefront without being preachy.
Yeah.
You know, soapbox.
That always seems like the thing that's difficult to balance with a lot of artists, that aspect of it.
And some people are afraid of it, and some people just don't know. You would think they do, but, man, it's a lot of people that they're clueless to what's going on out there.
Yeah.
And it also, for me, you know, I used to be the save the whales, save the trees. And I'll still write a song in that fashion. But, you know, the realization of it is that some people are just not there. And it's maybe not meant for them to be there.
Yeah.
But you still have to at least plant the seed and make them say, I wonder. And then, you know, it goes from there.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that's nice about those songs. And again, especially kind of having those songs on the same playing field as those makeup and breakup songs, is that it has the same kind of effect where it causes you to kind of think about things in a different way, because you're not hitting people over the head, you know, with a message. And you could just as easily with particularly with Turn Back, you could just as easily think of that song solely as like a relationship song, or you could get something deeper in it. You know, and like those kind of things, I think, are pretty rare in songwriting. And so, you know, I wanted to make sure that you knew how much I appreciated and how much I thought of those songs in particular. And with this record, it's finally going to come out, and it'll be available digitally. I would think it's also going to be available on vinyl. Vinyl has been something that seems like has been pretty important to kind of the story of Myron and E. So many of the early singles were out on 7-inch vinyl.
Correct.
Through either Stone's Throw or Now and Again or the Timian record label. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the importance of vinyl in particular, and kind of the reception that you guys got from DJs here in the States and overseas to people finding your music and kind of building what you were doing.
Yeah, it's been a great response to vinyl. I mean, the original 300 copies of Cold Game were actually hand-pressed in Germany on an old reggae-style record pressing machine. They were literally just take a hot ball of wax, press it down, somebody cut the edges off theyself. And it just went, you know, the record went around like that. And I think we might have got like a box of 50. And I took the records immediately to Groove Merchant and John Blunk. He was working, John Blunk from Sweater Funk, he was working at Rookie Ricardo's right up the street. Mm. in San Francisco, and he would, I gave him some of the a couple of copies of the record, and he would say, man, every time somebody come in here and I play this record, they buy it. He's like, this is really, really, really a good record. And I was like, wow, thanks, man. Thanks. I really appreciate it. But in turn, a lot of the people that were buying the records were DJs that had other nights, mm-hmm. or, you know, they had nights out DJing themselves. So it just became this huge phenomenon amongst DJs to have that initial 45. And the same thing with the second 45 when It's a Shame came out. It was pretty much the same reaction, man. People were really, really eager to get their hands on it and spin it. And the great thing about it was the record was only available on vinyl. Mm-hmm. So if you knew about it, or if you heard it, if you had any inkling as to what was going on, it was just like, hey, this, you have to go to a real record store. You can't log into iTunes and get it. You know, you got to go to a physical record store and buy this record. And then when Now Again came on and they reissued, they didn't reissue, but they licensed the record for North America. They licensed the first single, Cold Game, and the second one, It's a Shame. They licensed it for North America, but it was the same thing happened again, but it was just that much bigger because Now Again was behind it. It's definitely helped. It's helped a lot. I mean, it's helped a lot. But I think the biggest thing is it goes to the fact that DJs, you have to give DJs credit because they are the ones that are turning people on to music. And when they play it for you, you may not necessarily know what it is, but if you like it enough to go up and ask the DJ, hey, what's that record? It kind of plants that seed in somebody's mind and say, oh, that's that Myron and E record that, or if somebody else hears it and they say, oh, you haven't heard this? This is that record. So, yeah. And now the album will be out on vinyl as well, so you can get the full length on vinyl. And there will be a Fan Club 45 with two singles or two songs that...
Really?
Yeah. So
interesting. In talking about that, like they're especially thinking of those early singles, they're kind of some particular kind of like scenes that I really could have seen them jumping off in. Especially, I would have thought like Northern Soul kind of scene, especially those early ones. Mm-hmm. But as I think it was Myron kind of alluded to it earlier, one of the places where that really kind of embraced y'all's music was especially here in Southern California and Los Angeles and kind of lowrider scene. And that's something that you guys kind of pay tribute to in the video for If I Gave You My Love, working with the Southern Soul Spinners. And I was wondering just kind of both of those aspects of kind of like what it was like to realize that your music had kind of been embraced by that community and also to kind of witness that in the process of making that video too.
Right. Well, yeah.
It actually started in San Jose.
Yeah, it started in San Jose.
The
Stilettos Ball.
Yeah.
Okay.
Northern Stilettos.
A friend of mine in the Bay, Vinyl Richie, he was playing the record all the time. And one of the guys from the Stilettos Ball, they did a gig together and he played I Can't Let You Get Away. And Rob comes up, or Vinyl Richie walks up to him, and he said, I know those guys that made that record. And he was like, what are you talking about? This is an old record. He was like, nah, man, that's a new record. He's like, I know, that's E, that's E the Boss, like, that's him. And he was like, I can't believe it, you really know him. And so it was Vinyl Richie that actually put that whole process in motion with us to actually go and perform at one of their events up in San Jose. And I had no idea until they kind of found us, but I had no idea.
No, I actually grew up in South Central. I was born and raised here, and then I moved to the Bay. And a lot of my friends actually built lowriders, like the car clubs. And I remember there was a guy named Charles Clayton over by Locke High School. He would take the body off of the frame. And redo it, put the frame. I mean, it was extensive. And at some point, they were actually selling these cars, like 64 Impalas cut with Daytons, to guys over in Japan. In fact, I was in Australia one time and saw a lowrider over there, man, and I just, my mouth just dropped because that comes from L.A. That's an L.A. thing, you know. And these guys that I grew up with played the records. Now, the difference between, you know, the black community and the Hispanic community is that they never stopped playing it.
Yeah.
And, like, they're playing it today the same way they did back in the 60s. And their children are playing it, you know. And so when we did it up north, I was like, oh, man. And then when we came down here, I was like, oh, man. You know, I felt right back at home.
Yeah.
And I used to listen to the oldies. I mean, I've listened to a little bit of everything, but it was specifically like the Motown sound, and the Four Tops. You know, even like the seven, you know, the Delphonics and the Intruders. Like, I've had a chance to really sit and listen, and so it just becomes ingrained.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that as soon as I kind of heard that it had happened, like it made perfect sense just because, again, you know, just so many of those oldies that are venerated by that community have just, you know, just the sweetest melodies, you know, and melody and harmony is such a big part of your music that it, you know, it makes perfect sense that it would come together like that. In thinking about where things are going, because, you know, this record is coming out, and for those of us who've been aware of the singles, like, I want to say that first single came out in 2009?
Yeah, 2009.
Yeah? Right. Okay, and then a couple more in 2010, and I think maybe one in 2011. So we've kind of been waiting for this to come out for a while, and it seems like a lot of the work of this record, you know, some of it was done kind of recently, but a lot of the songs more or less were kind of together, you know, for a little while. Even though this record is already coming out, or is coming out right now, is it a situation where, because of that kind of time span, that you're already kind of writing new songs, have new material together, or are you going to kind of let things sit with this record, potentially tour connected to this record, and then kind of come back into the studio? Just wondering where you guys are going next.
I personally want to focus on this. Like I've discussed, you know, Ian and I have discussed working on future, you know, songs, so that we don't have a gap like this last time.
Mm.
But what's happening is we're being forced to be focused on this project right here, right now. And it's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a bad thing at all. But at least we already have the foresight to start writing and going forward with the next project. But let's see what happens with this first. And there are tours like set up for
August. The Stone's Throw Soul Tour is going to be the last 2 weeks of August, and I think the last show actually is here in Los Angeles. I'm not sure. I can't remember the venue right off.
It hasn't. It's to be announced.
Right.
They're still working
on
it.
Yeah, we'll figure
it'll
out.
It'll be on the Stone's Throw.com. Yeah. And then there's a European run.
Yeah, that's November, December. Yeah.
And we're trying to stick things in between that as well.
And when you go to Europe, are you going to actually be with the Soul Investigators?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And we were talking a little bit about this before the interview began, but what do you think the chances are of getting them to come out and back you here in the States?
That's budget, man. We have to keep growing this thing because it's a lot of those. It's easier to fly.
There's a lot of them.
It's easier to fly the two of us over there
and
to get a local band together than to have those guys come over and, you know, gear. And you can rent it out. I mean, you can rent stuff. But we also have, like, some shows on the 20th and 21st in Santa Monica.
That's in September. Yeah.
Okay.
But we're playing here. We have a show at the Bootleg Theater coming up also in September here in L.A.
Okay.
And a record release.
And then we have a record release on that's July 6th. Yeah, and that's going to be at Funky Soul with Clifton and Miles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's going to be a good one. We're just booking in more dates. We'll definitely be in LA a lot playing coming up.
I think the best way to keep up at this point, since things are just kind of still being confirmed and put together, is stonesthrow.com, because they'll post it up there.
Yeah, and we'll definitely keep people informed as things become more concrete, and hopefully be able to give away some tickets at later dates
definitely.
As well.
And also there's a Myron and E Facebook. So
just facebook.com/MyronE or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Just as easy as that.
And everything, the Instagram, Twitter, everything. You can find everything from there. So
yeah. When we post this interview and also the guest DJ set that you're getting ready to do, we'll make sure to throw up all the links as well. Just make it a little easier on people.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
But of course the number one thing to do is just to keep listening out. And just for right now, I just again want to thank you so much for coming in, and you know it's been really great to have this chance to chat with you after for a while. Even though I was in the Bay Area for you know a little while, didn't necessarily get to see either you up there and kind of found your music when I came down here.
Hmm.
It's nice to after these years of waiting and waiting and waiting
coming,
waiting for this record to come out.
Change gonna come.
The change came. Finally, the record came. I was so happy.
So
it's nice. It's really nice to be able to spend this time with you guys here.
Thanks so much for having us, man.
Yeah,
we
appreciate
that.
Yeah, and just as an added treat, we have you here to spin some records as well.
Yes, sir.
On all 45 vinyl, looks like.
That's right.
Which is always extra nice. So we're just going to take a little bit of a break right here. And then we'll throw it over to you guys for a guest DJ set. We've been talking with Myron and E here at KPFK, and they're also going to stick around and play you guys some records. So do stick around right now on KPFK 90.7 FM and Melting Pot.